Hello, I'm Jackie Jordan. This is number 0469, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0469. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Nate Hendley, author of The Boy on the Bicycle, which tells the story of a 14-year-old boy who was wrongly accused of killing a 7-year-old boy back in 1956 Toronto. What led him to this case?
What really caught my attention was the similarities with the Stephen Truscott case. I had written a book about Stephen Truscott. He was a 14-year-old boy wrongly convicted of murder in 1959 and then was later acquitted. And I got an email from this guy, Ron Moffat, saying, well, I enjoyed your book on Truscott and I went through the same thing in the 1950s as a 14-year-old. So that was the initial attraction, was just that it was similar to the Truscott case, which I had written about. And it was a case I knew absolutely nothing about.
We remember actress Charlotte Ray, who passed away at the age of 92. We play an interview with her from 3 years ago when she was promoting her memoir written with her son called The Facts of My Life.
He said to me when I was 87 and a half, he said, Ma, it's time you wrote your memoir. And I said, you're a writer. Are you up for it? And he said, yeah, I think it would be a good thing. Instead of saying, and then I was this and I did this and this was so marvelous and all that stuff. I would just let it all hang out, my life. Some of it is sweet and some of it is very difficult, and so there it is.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0469 was Jackie Jordan, who was a film and TV producer and the brains behind TV Guestpert. And her company has been instrumental in helping to book guests on this show throughout the years. I truly appreciate everything Jackie and her crew does. You can find out more about her company, by the way, by going to her website at tvguestpert.com. And you can find that link by going to the Stuff File program and finding the show she just mentioned the number of. See how this all goes full circle? By the way, Jackie, in addition to being a fine film and TV producer, is just an all-around marvelous person. Thank you very much, Jackie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We have a bit of an update on that British woman who claims she has sex with ghosts. We told you about her just before Christmas. Well, now she says she's in a serious and sexual relationship with one, and they've even discussed having children. 30-year-old spiritual guidance counselor Amethyst Realm, and you really have to ask what it means to her to be a spiritual guidance counselor, hit the headlines last year when she reveals she's slept with 15 ghosts since breaking up with her fiancé 12 years ago. But now she's decided to take things to the next level and is in a pretty serious relationship with a ghost she met in Australia. The ghost, who Amethyst can't see but believes she can communicate and have sex with, has now returned with her to the UK and their relationship is progressing. Speaking to Australian website New Idea, she says, "One day, while I was walking through the bush, enjoying nature, I suddenly felt an incredible energy. I knew a new lover had arrived." She said, "It's pretty serious. In fact, we've even been thinking about having a ghost baby. I know that sounds crazy, but I've been looking into it, and I don't think it's totally out of the question." Okay, it's only when she gets to the part about having a baby that she realizes it all sounds crazy? Honey, crazy was many miles back. You are way off the map.
Recalculating.
Anyway, she believes phantom pregnancies are actually ghost babies, claiming they don't go to term because the human body and mind can't process them. Amethyst Realm, and by the way, that's got to be the worst name for a Bond girl ever, says she's gone off men completely and has had sexual relationships with another 14 ghosts. In another interview, she even mentioned that she joined the Mile High Club with a ghost. Bet she didn't declare that at customs. Wow. She's really into the whole Casper coitus, isn't she? And by the way, if they're planning their marriage, where are they registered? Bed Bath and Way Beyond? Also, do you feel like I do in assessing that perhaps her fiancé dodged a bullet 12 years ago when they broke up? Cray cray. Well, the list of offenses was long when 32-year-old Franklin Williams appeared in Cuyahoga County, Ohio Commons Plea Court on July 31st to be sentenced for aggravated robbery, kidnapping, theft, misuse of credit cards, and more, including cutting off his ankle bracelet late last year and fleeing to Nebraska, where he claimed he was hit over the head and lost his memory. But it was his courtroom behavior that spurred Judge John Russo to call for an extreme measure. During the hearing, Williams would not stop talking, even interrupting his own lawyers repeatedly over about 30 minutes. Finally, Russo ordered deputies to tape the defendant's mouth shut. Williams continued to talk until deputies applied more tape. And finally, Russo sentenced him to 24 years in prison. Gee, I wonder if after he was sentenced, if the tape was taken off. And do you think he's going to be that chatty with his cellmate? Because if he is, duct tape is going to be the least of his concerns. Parkour is for athletic people who aren't good enough to be gymnasts. Maybe that's why the running and jumping enthusiasts in this story had a tough time recognizing a convenient cable for the threat that it was. The incident happened in downtown West Palm Beach. Police said the unidentified man, along with two other people, scaled a building with intentions to train for parkour. The three subjects climbed a metal pipe at the rear of the building and gained access to the roof. They then walked along the rooftop until they came to what turned out to be a power pole. The victim attempted to walk on the pole when he touched a live wire and immediately received over 7,000 volts of electricity through his body. The two accompanying him told police there was an explosion and a white light. The two subjects climbed down off the building and found the victim in an alley where, incredibly, he was alive and breathing, but unresponsive. He's probably seeing premium cable channels when he closes his eyes now, too. You know, this, folks, is what we call a Darwin starter kit story, because you know that sooner or later, one of these clowns, if not all three of them, is going to find an incredibly elaborate way to remove themselves from the herd. And speaking of herds, a Florida sheriff's helicopter captured video of a fleeing suspect being chased and ultimately cornered by some unusual concerned citizens. A herd of cows. The Sanford Police Department said officers attempted to make a traffic stop on a Subaru SUV that had reportedly been stolen in nearby Brevard County, but the driver sped off and ultimately crashed into a ditch. The driver, 46-year-old Jamie Young, and passenger Jennifer Kaufman fled in different directions, while a second passenger remained at the scene of the crash and was arrested. Canines were able to track Young to some bushes, where police found her hiding and placed her under arrest. The Seminole County Sheriff's Office aerial alert team, summoned to help Sanford officers, tracked Kaufman and the helicopter crew captured video of the suspect fleeing through a cow pasture with a herd of cows in pursuit. The large group of cows is following her. For a good visual, a crew member says in the video, it looks like they might attack her. The cows did not end up attacking the suspect, but they helped lead officers on the ground directly to Kaufman. Richard Kondracki, owner of the cattle, says they have never acted aggressively before. I think they didn't realize who they were, he said. He went on to say, they panicked. The cows were nervous. That would make me panic if all those big cows came running at you. They didn't know them. They didn't know if they were there to hurt them or steal one of their babies. Kaufman and Young were booked on charges of drug possession, resisting arrest, trespassing, and petty theft. Oh, that's just a moving story. A classic example of herd mentality, a story where the criminal is utterly defeated. I'll stop now. Time for our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Nate Henley is the author of The Boy on the Bicycle. It's the true crime story that goes back to 1956 Toronto, the murder of 7-year-old Wayne Millett, and the 14-year-old who was wrongly accused and incarcerated for the crime. Nate joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Nate.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, I know this is not your first rodeo. You are familiar with the genre of writing true crime stories. So what is it about this particular story that goes back over 60 years that caught your attention?
Well, what really caught my attention was the similarities with the Stephen Truscott case. I had written a book about Stephen Truscott. He was the, 14-year-old boy, small town Ontario, wrongly convicted of murder in 1959, and then was later acquitted. And I'd written a book about this, and I got an email from this guy, Ron Moffat, from Sault Ste. Marie, saying, well, I enjoyed your book on Truscott, and I went through the same thing in the 1950s as a 14-year-old. And I thought, okay, that sounds a little weird. So I asked him a few questions, and then I checked newspaper files, because the Toronto Public Library has some great archives of Globe and Mail, Toronto Star from the 1950s, so I could check his story quite easily, and it turned out he was telling the truth, that there had been this awful murder of this little boy, Wayne, at this Canadian National Exhibition, 1956, and Mr. Moffat was indeed accused of the crime, wrongly convicted. So that was the initial attraction, was just that it was similar to the Truscott case, which I had written about, and it was a case I knew absolutely nothing about, that this was, as a true crime writer, I'm always interested in learning things I don't know anything about, and this was one of those times that it was complete news to me that this had happened to this, poor teenager in the 50s, and the more I dug into it, the more it sounded like he had really been quite screwed over by the, police, and his was a story that deserved telling. So that was the initial motivation.
Now, again, the book is called The Boy on the Bicycle, and basically
correct.
The situation is that this young boy was killed, and the main suspect was seen supposedly pedaling away?
Correct. The main suspect in the murder encountered a night watchman at the C&E and started chatting away with him, saying all this weird stuff about, do you guys find bodies in the bushes? And, hey, I just saw this kid who looked just like me run away from the C&E. And then this weird kid biked away. So the police believe that this was, the main, culprit in the murder. And as it turned out, the killer was a guy named Peter Woodcock, and he subsequently killed two more children in Toronto, as Ron Moffat languished, in custody. And in all three cases, Woodcock, would approach these kids on his bike and impress them with his nifty new racing bike and then offer to give them a ride. And then molest them and kill them. So the term "the boy on the bicycle" actually comes directly from newspaper accounts in the 50s, quoting the police, saying that the boy on the bicycle is the chief, is someone, a person of interest that the police want to speak to concerning, the murders and whatnot. And Mr. Moffat, who was 14, he was a former CNE employee, and he had the bad timing to run away from home shortly after little Wayne was murdered. His parents reported him missing. Police picked him up, and the next thing they decided he had committed this terrible crime, and they kind of coerced a confession out of him. Ironically, Ron couldn't ride a bicycle, something his mother actually confirmed the newspapers in the 1950s. He had a poor sense of balance and couldn't ride, so that was a rather significant point. But that is the explanation of the title of the book, The Boy and the Bicycle.
Well, it's that last point that when I read the information on this case and about mm-hmm. your book that I said, well, wait a minute. I can understand sometimes, unfortunately, how mistakes can be made in the course mm-hmm. of an investigation. But how do you gloss over the fact that the kid who you have arrested can't ride a bike?
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, there were a lot of things that were glossed over. The other fact is that several witnesses testified at trial that they had seen Ron Moffitt the night of the murder. They saw Ron Moffitt at the Metro Theater in Toronto and at various times from 5:30 to 9:30. So if he had been in the theater the whole time, obviously he couldn't have, you know, committed the crime. The Crown prosecutor said, well, he was at the theater, but we think he slipped out, stole a bike, even though he couldn't ride, biked to the CNE, where he had previously worked, so he wanted to just hang out at his old stomping grounds, encountered this poor little boy, Wayne. The boy annoyed him. Things got physical, and Ron Moffitt accidentally killed him by smothering him in the dirt. That was the Crown's presentation. And beyond Ron's confession, there was very, very little evidence actually entered in the trial. There was some dental evidence in which they claimed that Ron's teeth matched the bite marks on Wayne's body. Just to jump ahead, when Moffitt was tried for a second time in the spring of 1957, the same dental expert said, well, no, these bite marks didn't match. So you can sort of toss that evidence out the window. But yeah, there was all sorts of bizarre, glaring things that somehow got overlooked. As a juvenile, Ron was tried just by a judge, not a jury. So that might have explained part of it, because with a jury, you might have had a few people raising reasonable doubts, but with a judge, it's just his decision. And he decided that Ron was guilty, because after all, he confessed without any realization that the confession was coerced and that false confessions happen with alarming regularity even today. There's a study that I cited in my book in which a U.S. law professor examined a database of something like 900 exonerations in the U.S. and found that a very significant number, I believe it was like 16%, I'm just talking off the top of my head, involved a false confession. So these people had confessed to something and then were later, it was found they had nothing to do with it. There's a variety of reasons people give false confessions, but one of the main ones being youth. And Ron was interrogated without a lawyer or a parent present, which is still legal today, by the way. And that is a extremely, you know, puts the young offender at great risk of making a false confession or being so intimidated they kind of agree to anything. But there's a lot, to answer your question, there was a lot of red flags about the whole case, but I think authorities were determined to shut the case as quickly as possible and decided that Ron was their guy, and they put him, you know, put him away, found him guilty.
A lot of true crime books, depending upon their time frame, either the people involved in the story are dead or are not talking or are not capable of talking. But here's a situation with you where mm-hmm. somebody came to you who was actually the accused perpetrator and then later exonerated. Did that change in any way, the shape or form, the way you conducted yourself in collecting information and writing this book, knowing that you had firsthand knowledge of the person who was wrongly accused?
It did, absolutely. The two main things, it gave me a bit of a huge advantage because I could, you know, obviously quote directly from the person involved. I could ask Ron about his experiences in court. You know, was he scared? Was he depressed? I could ask him about his experiences being interrogated, his experiences later at the Guelph Reformatory. At the same time, I had to be actually doubly careful because as my background is a journalist and I've written other true crime books, I had to corroborate everything he said. So I would look through the records. I found a lot of, like I did a lot of research in old newspaper archives, and it would say February 1, 1957, Ron Moffitt committed to the Bowmanville Boys Training School. And that would confirm that he what he had said during an interview about being committed in February 1957. I was also helped by a fellow crime writer who gave me a package of photocopies of police and various court documents from the 50s because the Toronto police weren't hugely helpful in providing information. So these documents offered the police side of the story. So I had a copy of Moffitt's alleged confession. I had memos from police explaining the investigation. So that allowed me to give them a voice because the problem, and you kind of touch on this, Moffitt being 14 at the time is young enough that he's still alive today. He's 76. Pretty much all the other major players are dead. So I have to find a way to sort of give them a voice so it's not just, you know, the Ron Moffitt story and take his word for it. So I did a lot of archival research and, as I said, finding court and police documents and tried to fill it out, corroborate what Mr. Moffitt had said about his experiences and give voice to police. I had copies of the judicial rulings during his court cases, statements by police about other investigations, that sort of thing. So I was very careful to try to make this that it wasn't just a one-note kind of book, that it wasn't just, here's Ron, here's his experience, and that's it. I'm not going to sort of back it up with any kind of newspaper research or anything like that. I interviewed Ron, dozens of times on the phone, via email, on Skype, and in person. And I could only find a couple small things that where he had his information incorrect because he's remembering from 60 years ago. So he would occasionally, have a date wrong where he appeared in court or something like that. But the central core of his story was absolutely consistent, and I was able to, like I said, to corroborate everything he told me, which was, the main reason I went forward with the book, that if I had been unable to nail down objectively his experience, then I don't know if I would have gone forward with it.
We're talking with Nate Hendley here, who's the author of The Boy on the Bicycle. We have to take a break, but will we stick around and answer a few more questions?
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We'll take a break, and we'll be right back here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we will remember the life of actress Charlotte Ray, who passed away last week at the age of 92. We'll play a conversation that we had with her from a couple of years ago when she was promoting her book, The Facts of My Life. We'll also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. But right now, we will continue with our conversation with Nate Hendley, the author of the true crime novel, The Boy on the Bicycle. Nate, You mentioned earlier that the police were not necessarily forthcoming and helpful in writing this book. Why do you think that is?
Well, part of it involves having to dig through some very old files. I think just there's simply the inconvenience factor that the material. I did a Freedom of Information request with police, and the information I was looking for were like police memos and files from the 1950s. That stuff might be hard to find. And I also discovered that a lot of that material has just been thrown away. That was a bit of a shocker to discover that a lot of these old court files and police files aren't necessarily kept. So a lot of the material I used, as I mentioned, I received a package of information of photocopies of police files in the 50s. That had actually come into the writer's hands because it had been scheduled to be thrown out. So that probably explains a bit of it. And they might not have been too eager to help with a case that doesn't make them look very good either.
You mentioned there were very few people alive involved in this situation, Ron Moffat being one of the few. Is there anybody from Wayne Mallette's family who's still alive?
There is. I reached out to one of the family members. I wrote a letter and explaining who I was, what I was doing, and that I'd be interested in an interview. This is to one of Wayne's brothers, who is still alive. And I said, if you're not interested in an interview, at least this is a heads up that this book is coming out. I received a phone call from the brother's wife, who indicated he did not wish to participate in any kind of interview and was understandably quite upset, but they did appreciate that I'd give them a heads up because they said they had in the past, suddenly they'd be in a situation where someone would say, well, here's a new book that features information about the death of your brother. And so that could be obviously a rather shattering. So I didn't push that hard. I respected the family's wishes. I don't want to mention the name. I was hoping to get their insights, and I'm glad I reached out, but understandably, they're still pretty shook up about this 6 decades later.
How long was Ron Moffat incarcerated?
In total, he was only incarcerated about 8 months, but keep in mind, he was 14. He was labeled a child killer, which typically doesn't sit well with the, prison population. And it pretty much just messed up his life that he served his sentence in various places, like the Bowmanville Boys Training School. He tried to run away from there, was punished quite severely. He was made to stand on a tile floor in the winter with bare feet, that sort of thing. He was transferred to the Guelph Reformatory, which is a prison that housed adults and teenagers. So his experience might not have been, years and years and years, but it was significant enough to really shatter his personality for a long time. And the fact he never really received an official apology, he was acquitted, and the judge basically sort of like criticized him for not telling the truth to police. Sort of like, well, you're innocent, you're not guilty, but you should have told the truth, young man. And he never received any compensation because his parents couldn't afford a lawsuit. They were broke. So this incident, just destroyed him for quite a long time. And it's to his credit, he pulled his life together.
Well, I was about to ask, I know you're a journalist, not a therapist, but being in contact with him, how would you describe him as a human being having gone through this? Has he come out the other side? For instance, is he bitter or what was he like in recapping what has happened to him?
He was always a gentleman. He answered every question I ever asked him. And I asked him some tough stuff, obviously. Usually he would be very matter of fact. Occasionally he would have flashes of anger or bitterness because of his treatment. I was surprised that he wasn't as bitter as I was expecting. that if this happened to me, I might be like, he worked for subsequently for most of his adult life as a caretaker in Sault Ste. Marie. He has been married twice. He has three children. He has grandchildren. So he really pulled his life together, had a good family life, is enjoying retirement right now. And he has admitted to me that talking to me has been kind of therapeutic because he held this in for many decades, this whole story. I was astonished that he wasn't more angry and bitter about his experiences. As I said, for the most part, very matter of fact, he's quite, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the right word. He's a bit stoic. He's a bit of an old school kind of guy, an older generation that you don't really throw your emotions all over the place kind of thing. So he can come across as quite reserved. And he's not hugely chatty. Like, he'll give you the information you want, but he's not going to sort of talk at length for hours and hours, you know, bemoaning his fate kind of thing.
But you also you also described him as somebody who answered every one of your questions. And I was just wondering, do you think part of his personality was, it sounds like he's somebody who was amiable and wanted to please people. Do you think part of his personality is what got him in trouble in the first place when he was a 14-year-old boy?
Yeah. It's actually, research has indicated that police interrogations with juveniles, juveniles tend to be much more trusting and gullible. And when adults tell them things, they tend to be either tend to believe it. So, yeah, I think that did probably hurt him a bit, actually, when he was interrogated, because there's a tendency to, these guys are asking you very leading questions, and you're 14, they're an adult, they're cops, there's a tendency to sort of want to agree with them, you know, like you're in school at the time, and the teacher says something, and you're kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, sure, yeah, I did that. So, I think that probably didn't help. He wasn't beaten. I should emphasize that it's not a case that he was like tortured or anything, but he felt threatened by the interrogation, that he felt that the police were hinting that they might get rough with him or something.
Coverage of capital crimes by journalists, also in investigational procedures have changed since 1956.
Yes.
Coverage has changed since 1956. Forensics has changed since 1956. But could this happen again?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even though we have DNA today and we have security cameras, which could have picked up the movements of the killer and the actual crime, police still make mistakes. Courts still make mistakes. Look at Toronto Police, the recent investigation into the Barry Sherman and Honey Sherman killings. They were a very wealthy couple who were found dead. This is in the past year or so. And the initial police report was that it was a murder-suicide. And there was a reinvestigation, and then police said, well, actually, we made a mistake. It was a professional hit. It wasn't a murder-suicide. So this is a modern police force with, you know, all the money, all the technology, all the know-how, all the experience, and they still made this huge mistake. And you still have people confessing to stuff that they didn't do for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're, especially, you know, if they have a drug or alcohol problem, sometimes their memory is a bit muddled, sometimes they're threatened, sometimes they're kind of tricked into a confession. So absolutely, it could still happen again. I really hope it doesn't. My one little advocacy point is I'd like to see stricter protocols for police interviews with juveniles, that I think they should have lawyers or adults present when they talk to a young offender.
It's a fascinating story indeed. The book is called The Boy on the Bicycle. Nate, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I thank you, Peter. I look forward to, you know, hearing more of your programs, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Nate Henley, author of The Boy on the Bicycle. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0469, and you'll find links to Nate's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. The Environmental Protection Agency recently proposed setting a national standard for vehicle emissions for the first time since 1970. It could lead to substantial savings for car buyers and even save lives. Under rules proposed by the EPA, California would be prohibited from setting fuel economy standards that are different than the national standards. The average fuel economy level would rise to 37 miles per gallon by 2020, but then stay there through 2026. Let's be fair, we all want clean air. By setting a national fuel economy level like this, the increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the air would be so small, it would be measured in the 0.1% range, according to one study. So, the impact on the climate would be essentially zero. And the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that this fuel economy standard could save 12,700 lives because there wouldn't be as many small cars on the road. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we will remember actress Charlotte Ray, who recently passed away. We'll also share with you an idiot of the day, and we have much more Stuff File news to share with you on a program that is also heard on iTunes and at Google Play. You can hear this show at both of those locations, just to mention a few. Stitcher Smart Radio is also another place you can hear the show. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Here's something to remember if you ever feel like mocking a man holding power tools. A St. Louis, Missouri man faces a homicide charge in a fatal attack of a co-worker with a circular saw. 24-year-old Miguel Angel Franco Navarro and 37-year-old Israel Velez Flores were part of a four-man crew replacing shingles on the roof of a home outside the city of River Falls. There was no apparent argument, though in a recorded jail call, Miguel allegedly said that he had been teased prior to the attack. Witnesses told authorities Navarro cut Velez Flores with a circular saw, causing Velez Flores to fall backwards onto the garage roof, where Navarro continued to cut him. The two other co-workers reportedly jumped off the roof and hid until police arrived. Velez Flores sustained 10 sharp force injuries across his face, neck, and back. He died of his injuries on the garage roof. Well, this is something you're not going to see in any of those home hardware commercials. Are we going to have to start registering power tools now? In Bluffton, South Carolina, 32-year-old Lauren Elizabeth Cutshaw informed police officers she was a former cheerleader, sorority girl, good student, and National Honor Society member after they pulled her over at 1:45 a.m. on August the 4th for running a stop sign at 30 miles per hour over the speed limit. She also told officers she shouldn't be arrested because she's, quote, a very clean, thoroughbred white girl. She said she'd had only two glasses of wine, but then allowed, I mean, I was celebrating my birthday. Police arrested her anyway and booked her into the Beaufort County Detention Center. Oh, there is so much I could say about this story of a 32-year-old woman playing the white privilege card. But all I will say is that she should just shut up and be thankful that somebody didn't shoot her.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book, What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
A Florida man has been arrested for threatening to blow up a woman's house after she turned down his proposition for a sexual encounter. The Miami Herald reports that 41-year-old Florida Keys resident Nicholas Kevin Chu was arrested for sending a threatening text message to a woman who is a friend of Chu's girlfriend. According to police, Chu asked the 37-year-old woman to have sex with him, and she refused while asking him if he knew that she was a lesbian. Chu eventually responded by texting her back, "I will blow your bleeping house up." The woman then went to police and told them she was scared to return home because of the threat that Chu made to destroy her house. Chu subsequently told police that his threat was merely a joke and a misunderstanding. Chu was arrested on a felony charge of committing written threats to kill or do bodily injury. Oh, what I'd give right now to hear what his girlfriend has to say about all of this. I'm guessing that whenever he gets out of jail, she won't exactly be waiting for him with open arms, unless one of those arms contains a rolling pin. Anyway, let's get to our next segment here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? It's time to remember someone who we recently lost. Actress Charlotte Ray, best known for her role as Mrs. Garrett on the TV show Different Strokes and The Facts of Life, passed away last week at the age of 92. It was only 3 years ago, back in 2015, that she released her memoir entitled The Facts of My Life, which is published by Bear Manor Media. That's when I had the chance to talk to this very funny, very talented lady about her life and career.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you.
So you've now come up with your memoir. It's been a little while since the television shows The Facts of Life and Different Strokes have been on. What made you decide to write this memoir now?
Well, it was my son who decided. I mean, he said to me when I was 87 and a half, he said, "Ma, it's time you wrote your memoirs." And he's a writer. And I said, "Well, I never thought of it because I'm not a writer. But you're a writer. Are you up for it?" And he said, "Yeah, I think it would be a good thing." And so we did it together. And as we were writing it, I thought, well, instead of saying, and then I was this, and I did this, and this was so marvelous, and all that stuff, I would just let it all hang out, my life. Let it all be out there like everybody else's life. Some of it is sweet, and some of it is very, very difficult. And so there it is, my life.
You've written this, as you say, with your son, right? That would be Larry Strauss?
Yeah, Larry Strauss. As in Johann Strauss, and he's a writer. He's written wonderful books, and he's also a teacher in a school in South Central Los Angeles, and he works with mostly African American and Latino students and encourages them to move on and educate themselves and get into college, and tries to help those who could apply themselves into getting scholarships and raising funds for their books and, you know, lodgings and all that stuff. You know, he likes his work. Yes, he does. And he's a good writer and a good teacher. And he's the athletic director at the school, too.
What's it like writing a book like this, which basically tells your life story, with your own son? I mean, that must be, in addition to just the fact that you're writing a book with your son, must be a bonding experience with the two of you.
It was indeed. And there were a few moments that came to light where I made amends to him, you know, for things that I could have been a little more attentive to him, because I was involved with my divorce and involved with my other child, who was challenged, and so it was a very rich, powerful experience.
You had to place your child in an institution, correct?
That was something that happened at the long end of a long road of trying to do something that I thought would be better for him. But we did find a wonderful place in California. It no longer exists, but it was Camarillo, and they had a wonderful, wonderful unit for those developmentally disabled. And there was a wonderful parent group involved, and we would take them out and do things with them, and Easter was a big deal, and Christmas, and the parents were involved, and my husband and I were involved, and Larry, and then they sold it to and put a college there instead, and that was kind of sad because it was a wonderful place, and but it was wonderful when he had it. It was wonderful.
As an actress, you have spent a lot of time working on various series with children. Was that a constant reminder to you not only as an actress but as a mom of what had gone on in your own life, working with kids all the time?
Well, the first one was Sesame Street. I was Molly the mail lady on Sesame Street with Oscar the Grouch and Big Bird, and the kids were so adorable and beautiful, and it was very difficult for me because they were so precocious and delightful and normal and seemingly happy, and it was hard because I was with a child who had deep challenges and. And then the facts of life and the different strokes. Oh, I loved being with them. I really did. And it wasn't painful. That was not painful. By that time, we were kind of in a good situation with Andy in California with the wonderful Camarillo. It was wonderful, Camarillo State Hospital. Charlie Parker was there for his drug thing. He wrote a song about Camarillo. I don't know if it's called Flying in Camarillo. I don't know. I can't remember. Anyway, that's true. I was with a lot of children. Now, I did a lot of other sitcoms, but that's true. There were three of them. Mm-hmm.
You were also working in a time much different to today, and by that I mean now we have Twitter and Facebook and the tabloids, and people can't seem to have a private life and do the kinds of things that the average people could do, the average person can do, without it being under the microscope of somebody online. With all that's gone on in your life, and you talk about it in your book, you talk about your son, you talk about discovering that your husband of 25 years was gay. You discuss all this in your book, yet at the time that all this was going on, the general population had no idea, right?
None. Nobody had any idea. No. No, I don't. No. No, well, I mean, I was never anyone who went in for all the PR that some people do, you know. I led a very quiet life. I was busy with the kids and with the work, you know.
You also, I mean, again, we know you from television, but you had a career that goes back to Broadway as well. You worked the boards. Was that something that, because whenever I talk to actors, especially film and television actors, they always go on about how much they enjoyed working the stage. Are you in that category as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing like the theater. Nothing like it. Wow. You know, I was the original Mammy Yoakum and Little Abner on Broadway. And I don't want to talk about all the wonderful things that I was able to do. I'm so grateful for it. But I had a long, long, wonderful life. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing something in the spring at the Kirk Douglas Theater in L.A. It's a Samuel Beckett play called Endgame. And I did I've done Shakespeare in the Park, you know, with Stacy Keach and Sam Waterston and I forget his name. Anyway, Romeo and Juliet. I was the nurse and Mistress Quickly in Henry IV, Part One, Part Two, and then there was a Samuel Beckett play, a beautiful play called Happy Days. Not like the series Happy Days, but a woman who's stuck in a mound, and from the waist up she's okay, and then in the second act, the mound is up to her neck, and it's Samuel Beckett, and it's a challenge, and I loved it. She was a wonderful, noble soul, and I don't know. I've done so many wonderful roles, and I'm so grateful. But I love television. I love film. I love it all. I love it.
And one of the things, I mean, even though you've done everything, again, you're so well known for the characters you've played on television, and they were such fun, loving characters. I get the feeling that when you meet fans on the street, all they want to do is hug you.
You want to know something funny? About a year and a half ago, when I was in New York, we took the subway down to see a play, my friend and I, and we took the subway back up, and this tall, nice-looking young man, he obviously grew up with the Facts of Life and Mrs. Garrett, and he went, ah! And he was in the subway station going in, and I was going out, and he went, and I went, oh. And we hugged, and that was it. And then he went down the stairs to the subway, and I went out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I wish I could give you a hug now. Charlotte, the book is called The Facts of My Life. It tells so much about your life, both on the stage, on television, and your personal life, and some of the people you've worked with over the years and even went to school with, like Paul Lynn, Patricia Neal, and Cloris Leachman. It's chocked full of information. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us, Charlotte.
Well, you're a lovely interviewer, and if I ever get to Montreal, I'll give you a jingle. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was a conversation from November of 2015 with actress Charlotte Ray. She was just an adorable woman inside and out. She was on the show talking about her memoir, The Facts of My Life, published by Bear Manor Media. Charlotte passed away last week at the age of 92. As I mentioned, her book is chocked full with stories about her life and career. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this program, which is show number 0469, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you and, of course, an idiot of the day. Stories like this one. A Florida woman landed in jail after she allegedly streaked around a park in broad daylight to escape a giant spider. Police arrested 40-year-old Danielle Teeples after they discovered her stark naked Sunday afternoon at a public park in St. Petersburg. Officers arrived to find Teeples acting erratically and rubbing her hair and breasts as she screamed and ran between two trees, according to a police report. Teeples reportedly refused to get dressed and told officers that she disrobed because there was a giant spider on her. She then admitted to recently using drugs, including meth and crack cocaine. Teeples was arrested and booked on charges for exposure of sexual organs. Gee, I hope they found the spider. And by the way, notice the actual charge is exposure of sexual organs. Who originally wrote that statute? Wouldn't the word genitals suffice? Police have arrested a 35-year-old man suspected of calling in a bomb threat to a Las Cruces, New Mexico eatery. Emmanuel Soriano had been charged with one count of unlawful bomb scare. The charge is a crime against public peace and is a fourth-degree felony. About noon on August the 8th, Las Cruces police were dispatched to the report of a bomb threat at the Corner Bakery. The business was cleared and nothing suspicious was located. Police learned that Soriano is related to one of the store's employees and had made multiple telephone calls to the business during the morning trying to talk to his relative. The relative refused to take any of his phone calls. Investigators confirmed that the call came from near Soriano's residence. Soriano indicated to investigators that he made the bomb threat because the store was no longer taking his calls. So, I'm guessing the person at the bakery isn't the one phone call Soriano will be making from Doña Ana County Detention Center, where he is being held without bond. And I also guess that he truly does miss the good old days before call display. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. Yes, you know it, you love it, you can't wait for it each week. It's time now for The Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff out presents The Idiot of the Day.
A driver's license examiner in Glen Burnie, Maryland, got a whiff of something illegal on August the 6th when she approached a car about to be used in a test drive. She called Maryland State Police, who found 22-year-old Reginald D. Wooding Jr. of Baltimore waiting in his mother's car to take his test. But he never got the chance. Wooding was in possession of marijuana, a scale, more than $15,000 in suspected drug-related money, and a 9mm Glock handgun with a loaded 30-round magazine. Oh, dear Lord, his mother must be so proud. Because why, oh why, would you prepare to take your driving test in a weed-odorous vehicle loaded with drug cash and a loaded weapon? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0469. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0469. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.